Today on New Horizons, Philip Fradkin, author of Wallace Stegner and the American West.
I can't think of a greater legacy for any person who teaches than to have the memory of you embedded in that student's mind for the rest of their life. Stegner hated his father, and he never got rid of that hate. He was an activist, too, and I couldn't think of another character who had those contributions to the nation as a whole and in terms of the American West.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Philip L. Fradkin is one of the nation's most acclaimed nonfiction authors writing about the American West. He is the author of 11 books. His latest book, Wallace Stegner and the American West, was published in February 2008. Since his first professional writing job in 1960, Mr. Fradkin has worked at all levels of the craft of nonfiction. He shared a Pulitzer Prize while working at the Los Angeles Times for his reporting on the Watts riots. He taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford, and he served for 5 years as the Western editor of Audubon magazine. Mr. Fradkin's previous works have dealt with such subjects as the use of water and land, nuclear fallout, California, and earthquakes. He lives on the coast north of San Francisco and is currently working with his photographer son Alex on a book about the California coast. Today, Phil Fradkin joins us on the phone from his home in California. Philip Fradkin, welcome to New Horizons.
Well, it's nice to be on your program, Bob.
Well, let's begin with the title of this book. It's Wallace Stegner and the American West, which, as I told you before we started this interview, I found so fascinating because I learned a great deal about the history of the West, especially during Stegner's time, but even beforehand. This is the third biography written about Stegner, so maybe you can help us understand how that you, the author, takes a look at another author, in this case Stegner, and says, well, a third is needed. Why is a third needed?
Well, that's a good question. I can answer it simply, then I go into more detail. The two previous biographies, the first was written in 1977 by a professor whose name escapes me right now at University of California, Santa Cruz, and obviously Stegner's life and work hadn't been completed. And the last one, most recent one before mine, was written and published in 1996. And the author of that worked under the very tight censorship of Mary Stegner, who withheld permission until he made certain changes. So along with the fact that it was generally considered as a hagiography, and he didn't go into some areas as deeply as I thought he should, I quickly determined that there was certainly a room for a third biography. Now, you mentioned the title, and that has an interesting story, because the book is not a literary biography, and I had a difficult time, and I don't know how anyone in the West can imagine I would, selling the idea of a biography of Wallace Stegner. But not only a biography, because his life spanned the American West from the frontier days in the early 20th century to Silicon Valley at the end of it, I thought it was also a good way to bring in the history of the American West as the constant background for his life. So the title reflects both those aspects, Wallace Stegner and the American West.
Now, you mentioned Mary Stegner, and she was difficult for the second biographer to deal with. Paige Stegner, the only son of Mary and Wally, went, of course, on to get his Ph.D. in literature. He tried his hand at writing himself. And you mentioned Paige Stegner in here. In fact, I believe toward the end of the book, when you write these little vignettes on the states, you talk about how Paige actually took you around. He took you to Vermont and you walked the cemetery, not where he's buried, of course, but just to get a sense of the place that this Vermont was to Stegner. How was Paige Stegner in helping you better understand his father?
Well, he was extremely cooperative, and I'm sure I couldn't have done the biography, nor maybe would I have gotten Mary Stegner's permission if she had been in better health. But Paige at that point, about 4 years ago, I was the executor of the literary estate. In fact, the idea arose with Page indirectly. We'd known each other slightly, and he knew I had some contact with his father. So in the fall of 2003, he wrote me a letter asking if I had any letters from his father, because he was putting together a volume of selected letters, which subsequently was published last fall by Shoemaker and Hoard. And I think it's called The Selected Letters of Wallace Stegner.
Yes.
And that is available in a bookstore or can be ordered. When I got the letter, unfortunately, I didn't have any letters. I had had a house fire in the meantime and lost all those letters along with a lot of other things. And so, but I thought for a while, and the proverbial light bulb went on, and I said, what about a biography of Wallace Stegner? So I emailed him back and said, you know, what do you think if I undertook a biography of your father? He said, yes, great idea. There's room for another one, but I don't want another hagiography. Now, I'm not an academic, and that word sent me to the dictionary, where I figured out what it meant and emailed him back and said that certainly wasn't my intent. So Page was incredibly helpful. I visited him in Vermont. He took me over to the house that he and his father had built. He showed me around the small community. We spent a night at the Stegner home shortly before it was sold in Los Altos Hills. And we shared a trip with my son and his daughter on Lake Powell, in the exact area where Wallace Stegner had spent some time camping with the Park Service just before Glen Canyon Dam was completed and the reservoir was filling. Interesting enough, when we were there, the reservoir level was way down because of the drought in the West. The drought that Stegner and the lack of water, that Stegner in many ways, in many of his works and talks, had predicted, and which now is omnipresent throughout the Colorado River drainage.
Is the home in Los Altos Hills simply occupied by another homeowner? It's not set aside or anything?
Well, that's another interesting question concerning Stanford University. When Page said he wanted to sell the house, I undertook a little crusade and enlisted his help. And to me, there's no memorial to Wallace Stegner other than his wonderfully preserved house in East End, Saskatchewan, which is a writer's and an artist's retreat run by the folks in that little town. And that original home that George Stegner built in 1916, I believe, is in excellent condition and is the Stegner house and is used. And that's the only memorial that Wallace Stegner has. I thought the Los Altos home would make a wonderful place. It could be a library. It could be a retreat. It could be a writer's a seminar or something. And Page followed up that idea, and the response he got from Stanford, which is a very money-conscious institution, was, well, if you give it to us, we'll sell it. Page was not interested in giving it to Stanford University, so it unfortunately, the house was not preserved. Somebody bought it. I don't know whom, and Page told me that they've kept it pretty much the way it was, although it was needed a lot of repairs. But
sure,
that's the story of the house and the fact that there is no lasting memorial left for Wallace Stegner. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the folks in Salt Lake City are planning. They're going to have a big centennial conference in March of 2009. Maybe something will be done in Salt Lake. I'm not sure.
Well, we'll have to keep our listeners posted on that conference. That could be very, very interesting. You mentioned George Stegner, his father. He had a rough relationship with his father. I wonder if you could just explain the problems George Stegner had and why Wallace came away with such negative memories and how they worked themselves, it seems anyway, into some of Stegner's characters.
The problem he had is fascinating. I tried to track down a name for it, talked to various psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists and so forth. It doesn't seem to be a name that I could find for it, at least. The male members of the Stegner family, beginning with his father, proceeding to Wallace Stegner, to his son Page Stegner, and to Page's son, four generations have this characteristic of anger. something setting them off and reacting in sometimes violent ways. We can't trace it back any earlier than George Stegner, because he never, Wally never talked very much about his father, and his father probably never talked very much to him about the lineage. But George Stegner was an abusive father. He had a sort of a wimpy, crybaby son in terms of what Wally was as a young boy. And George was a big, husky guy who was very much a teller of stories. He was a gambler. He made a living as a bootlegger. And he lived on the gray side of the law, and his family had to live there in a similar way throughout the time in Saskatchewan, later in Great Falls, and then Salt Lake City. And he beat Wally up at times. And so Stegner hated his father, and he never got rid of that hate. And Bo and the Big Rock Candy Mountain and the father in Recapitulation, Bo is very much Wallace Stegner's father, particularly in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. And most of those incidents in there are incidents that happened to Wally Stegner. Now, he had a real hatred for his father, to the point where in the family cemetery in Salt Lake City, his mother and his brother have a small stone, but there's no stone for his father, and that was up to that Wally to get, and he never did. Sure. He had, on the other hand, he had an obsessive love for his mother, and he admitted that it was Oedipal, but he said, you know, Oedipal is not that rare, and he never felt that he had served his mother well, but he had done that. He never could have, to the point where he would have been satisfied. He loved his mother. He felt somewhat guilty because he wasn't there all the time while he was getting his degrees at the University of Iowa, but he was back there when she needed his help, and his father was absent. So that mother, that nesting type of person, and that adventurous ne'er-do-well, those characters are written into a lot of his novels, and they exist to some extent in Angle of Repose.
And here's what I find so fascinating, and correct me if I misread something, but given what a difficult relationship he had with his father, then I could only predict that when he has his own child, he's going to heap upon this child the attention and the devotion that perhaps he felt lacking in his own father-son relationship. And yet you talk, I think, in the book about how Wallace and Mary were so unbelievably devoted to each other that Wallace as a child actually suffered from that. I mean, he was not in a physical way. There was no physical violence that I remember you talking about. But he even knew and understood that he couldn't get in the way of this incredible, strong relationship between husband and wife, and he was the son.
Well, I think you mean Paige couldn't get in the way.
Paige, yeah.
I think
you
said Wallace. Yeah. Well, Wally chased Paige. This is a story that Paige told me with a sigh once. He was out sighing the field, and Paige was a really meddlesome, as he admitted, teenager. And he just said something to his father, and that bango, that anger gene went off. And Wally chased him with that sigh. And luckily, that little kid could run pretty quick. I don't think once he caught up, he would have done anything, but that anger gene, you would think that something would change. I mean, that's the rational way things happen. But, you know, life isn't rational. And I think Wally, he was a nurturing father in the sense that when Paige was young, there was a breech birth and his leg was malformed. And it was Wally who was the person who massaged the leg, according to Paige. And it was his mother, Mary, who was the mother who really didn't want a child, and Paige had gotten in the way. And so up to, I think, maybe the teenage years, Wally and his son got along well. But then, you know, the late 50s and early 60s were a difficult time, and Paige rebelled, and Wally couldn't deal with that. So it doesn't necessarily follow that behavior changes. I'm more of the school where people may want it to change, but in fact, we're sort of all saddled with our pasts. And that's what Stegner kept exploring through his own experience, because he was a realist. But through his own experience and through such biographical characters as John Wesley Powell, and others, he explores the past of the West, and he gave the West, I think, more than any other person, any other writer, well, any other person, because he was three things. He was a writer, he was a teacher of writers and a conservationist. He gave the West more than any other person a sense of its past. And people have gone on since then, myself to a slight degree, others, Ivan Doig up your way, and Barry Lopez, and Terry Tempest Williams, and any number of other writers working in the West have gone on to follow that path that he blazed in sense of giving the West its history. I mean, we're a very young country. We're even a younger region of the country. We don't treasure history. I can perhaps say that in California with more veracity than maybe Idaho, because the phrase, "that's history," down here is a very dismissive phrase, and we live in the present, but we have the past which governs and determines to a large extent who we are. And that's been a theme in my writing for a number of years.
You're listening to Philip L. Fradkin. He is the author of Wallace Stegner and the American West. As you can tell, we're talking about that biography that Philip has just written. It was available February 2008. You can find it at the bookstore. Let's talk about that in distinguished list of authors who came to the seminars that Stegner conducted over time. Wendell Berry from Kentucky. I interviewed Wendell Berry for this very show, and this show was at another university, Eastern Kentucky University. And remember him talking about the influence Stegner had on him. One of the things about Stegner as a writer and teacher is that he seems to have left a legacy when it comes to creative writing programs, and I'd like your thoughts on that. And I guess the other question, I always ask writers this, and it's impossible to answer, I suppose, but this incredible cast of characters who are now writing their own works, did they go to Wallace Stegner and truly learn how to write, or did they simply hang out with a guy who inspired them? They knew how to write. It was a matter of perhaps putting their lives and place in perspective, but the actual craft, I mean, do you think Stegner was the teacher of the craft, or was he the inspiring novelist who, if you hung around this guy and sipped wine with him two or three nights a week, you're bound to come away a better and more committed writer?
Well, answer the last question first by quoting you what Wendell Berry said, which is the best expression that I could find, along with a number of pages which I devote to how he was so effective. The best single expression I could find explains what writers got from him in his classes, and this is what Wendell said. And so Wallace Stegner became my teacher before I'd ever laid eyes on him. He's talking about a collection of his essays that he read before he went to Stanford. And he was already teaching me in a way that I have come to see as characteristic of him. Dash, and this is important, by bestowing a kindness that implied an expectation and by setting an example. So that's the best description that I came across of how and why and in what way Stegner was such an effective writer. And there were people who went through his creative writing classes at Stanford, included not only Wendell Berry, but Ed Abbey and Ken Kesey, Larry McMurtry, Robert Stone, Scott Turow, and that's just to mention a few. And then there were the people who weren't in his classes, but who were his friends or who he mentored. I'm thinking of Terry Tempest Williams. I'm thinking of Barry Lopez. I'm thinking of Ivan Doig off the top of my head. And then there was a third class, again, students. And this was what I think you can appreciate in terms of how either you want to be remembered or how the most effective way you are remembered as a professor. And that's not, I don't think, and the number of graduate students you've advised who've gone on to teach in the same field. It's the number of students who come back to you, mainly through letters, and say, "Hey, prof, I'm not doing so well, or I'm doing great. I'm not writing or whatever, but boy, thanks a lot." And those letters that I went through at Stanford reams and reams of them that came from all over the country, from people who apologized for not writing, for people who said they had written a couple of books, for people who said they were going to write the books, who had gone through his classes. That was an incredible experience for someone like myself who has taught and would like to be remembered in that way. And I can't think of a greater legacy for any person who teaches than to have the memory of you embedded in that student's mind for the rest of their life.
Boy, that says it all. You mentioned Kesey. I was fascinated by what apparently was a rougher relationship between Ken Kesey and Wallace Stegner, as though they were from different generations. And I think you had a great quote in there that I can't quote verbatim, but it was, I don't know whether it was Stegner or Kesey saying it. I think it might have been Stegner who says, well, Ken likes to dabble in drugs, and I use scotch or something to that effect.
Well, bourbon. But it was Kesey who said that. But it was a very good quote because it pointed out the difference in generations and the difference in lifestyles. And it's why they didn't get along. It's also one of the points in Stegner's life where his anger gets in his way and he can't seek a reconciliation. You cross him once and you are off his list forever. And Kesey crossed him once in an interview that was particularly derogatory, and he knew immediately after giving the interview and seeing it in print that he made a mistake, and he went to Stegner's office. Stegner wouldn't let him in. Wouldn't let him in his life for the rest of the years that Kesey was alive. But Kesey paid Stegner the ultimate compliment. He said, in terms of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that Stegner taught him that point of view was crucial, and the story is told through the mind and the mouth of the American Indian, and you couldn't have told the story any better from a point of view than through that character. And so Kesey got something from Stegner, and Stegner didn't want anything more to do with Kesey. He also ran afoul of Gary Snyder. That was another generational thing. And so in some places throughout his life, and this is one of the downsides, this is one of the points I bring out in the book, and it's one of the things that some of the reviewers picked up. It wasn't just a complimentary book. That it attempted to do what I wanted to do, and that was give the whole man. His anger got in the way. His anger got in the way so much that he took his papers out of Stanford and sent them to the University of Utah just because Stanford had hired a professor after he left that he didn't like. So he was a charming man. I met him once. He was incredibly kind to me. But he could really be an angry man, too.
Let's talk about Angle of Repose for a moment, because, of course, it's the story of Mary Halleck Foote, who came here with her husband, Arthur, as he was engineering irrigation ditches in the area. And, of course, Stegner then decided to use her biography, maybe I'll say roughly, but you have to be the one to make that call. And in the process, he got into trouble. There were plagiarism claims. When it's all said and done, how does it wash out for Wallace Stegner? Is it just simply a case of, well, he should have kept the family better informed, and beyond that, it really wasn't plagiarism? Or, I mean, how do you make that final call on whether Wallace Stegner did was plagiaristic or not?
Well, he used large sections of Mary Halleck Foote's letters, either verbatim, slightly changed, or in fact invented. And he was under a great deal of constraint because the family didn't want him to identify her, although her memoir was about to be published by Huntington Library. And there is the issue of plagiarism, and some people feel strongly on both sides. It had never been dealt with fully before, so a fair amount of the book deals with that issue. And I come down on the side that everyone made mistakes. Stegner, without giving the family's identity away, could have said more explicitly what had come from another source. The family itself, when offered the manuscript to read, turned down that offer. They should have read it. Interesting, it comes down to an incident in the book, an ambiguous incident that Stegner invents in Boise, on the canal that Arthur Foote is, or the his fictional character, and it's Arthur Foote also, is building out right outside of in Boise, and that is an incident which Stegner invents because he wants to give the character, the woman, Mary Halleck Foote's counterpart, greater depth than her memoir indicates, and he invents this incident which he purposely fudges, but it hints at adultery and it hints at filicide. In other words, there was another character he invented, and something happened. We're not sure which. While it's happening on the banks of that irrigation ditch, the young daughter drowns. Well, the young daughter didn't drown there in real life. She later died in California. And as far as anyone knows, Mary Halleck Foote never had an affair that came close to constituting adultery. But that's what the family took umbrage at, and that's what a lot of defenders of the theory of plagiarism say he should have been more explicit about. So, to some extent, the issue comes down to what happened outside of Boise.
Exactly. You know what's so fascinating about Stegner? Here's a guy who was raised in the East but moves West and spends his entire life in the West, not only as a writer and a teacher, but as a conservationist, and played such a strong role. And yet,
well, that's true. I'll just correct that slightly. He was born in Iowa, and
that's right,
and almost immediately taken to the Puget Sound area. So the Iowa experience was very marginal.
So why does he desert the great American West in his senior years to go to Greensboro, Vermont?
He gave up on the West. He couldn't deal with change, and as his life typifies, change is the most outstanding human characteristic, cultural characteristic in the American West, or I believe it is. You know, he pointed out aridity as being the greatest physical characteristic. That's true, and it's changed, and I'm sure people in Idaho are very much aware of it. That's the outstanding human characteristic. He couldn't deal with it. Unfortunately, he had put his roots down in what became the Silicon Valley of the 1990s, 1980s and 1990s, and that disturbed him greatly. Also, what was happening in Salt Lake City and Albuquerque and Denver, the whole urbanization of the West. He found the values of his frontier upbringing in Saskatchewan best preserved in Vermont, along with the landscape, which recuperates very quickly, and the sense of traditions. So he asked that his ashes be spread over the ferns outside his small summer home on the lake in Vermont, and that's where his remains were taken and spread. And in a sense, and that's one of the most tragic things about Stegner, is that he was always seeking a home because he was so homeless in his youth for so long, and he never really found it. And when he did, I think he found sort of a false home. He found a home in New England because of his reaction against what the West had begun. He never quite got his roots down, both in terms of a home and in terms of coming to terms with his father and his mother. But he made those attempts, which is a lot more than a lot of us do.
Well, you've done a masterful job of summing up this man's life. And again, I am so fascinated with him because I think he was warning us throughout his entire career of how we're abusing the landscape. You've captured that masterfully in this book. And let's just hope that we can get enough people to read it and reflect on what he was trying to tell us. It's too bad he gave up, but we don't have to give up. And Philip Fradkin, I'd like to thank you for not giving up and giving us a great biography of Wallace Stegner in the American West.
Well, thank you, Bob, for taking interest in the book and for summing it up so well yourself. What Stegner did has a great deal of relevance to who we are today in the American West.
The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.